preserve its strength. The world only sought to hold us down. And we have now risen, but we have done so only by our own might. You know that peoples aren't responsible for things that happen. What we are concerned with here in these post-war settlements is a gang of international profit grabbers. Our love of peace is demonstrated. Germany demands equality, but is prepared to grant general disarmament, even down to the last machine gun. Germany is prepared to offer peace. We made the offer, and the offer was declined. Again and again, my proposals were turned down. I offered to abolish poison gas. I offered to secure non-combatants against bombardment. I offered definitely to limit air warfare. It was all in vain. And then, since this was futile, I ordered German arms prepared. And we have today armaments such as the world has never seen. I took no half measures. I am a National Socialist and a German frontline fighter. And today, you Germans have your weapons. For 5 years, I have armed you. I've used billions for that purpose. I have given my friend Goering an air force which will protect Germany against all attacks. The world will know it and will respect it if it ever has occasion to contact it. We have the best anti-aircraft defense in the world. We have the best anti-tank defense. And I'm going to speak of this again. I have followed a peace program. I wanted to save the German people. I've tried to follow the path of peace. And the most difficult problem that I had to confront at the beginning of my term of service was the German-Polish problem. That might easily have developed into a hysterical attitude on both sides. Now, I couldn't have succeeded in solving that problem if Poland had been a democratic nation. All these democracies. In Poland, there was no democracy. There was a man. For 10 years, we have eliminated all danger of a clash between us. And we are determined to make this peace pact permanent. We are two peoples who will live. And I can well understand that a people of 33 million must have access to the sea. There are places where nationalities clash, places in the world. Now, at that point, I began to translate Mr. Hitler's address, and I'm afraid that from that point on, I won't be able to give you a very accurate translation because I only noted down a casual word here and there and tried to carry the sense in my head. But let me turn over my pages to get down to the essential point. Of course, as you know, he discussed for quite a while the problem of self-determination. The indication that the democracies were perfectly willing to accept that when it was there to their advantage, but refused to accept it when it was to their disadvantage. And he cited what he called the history of self-determination. Of course, he said, when it comes to the Czechs, they did not permit self-determination to be applied to that state. The Czech state began with a lie. This man Beneš, he was there in Versailles. And then these geographical experts, these Anglo-Saxon treaty makers, what did they create? They created a state made up of Slovaks and Czechs and Hungarians and Poles and Ukrainians and Germans. And then they called it Czechoslovakia, a state that was a permanent denial in itself of the right of self-determination. And then, after Mr. Beneš lied this state into existence, there came a regime of terror. A regime of terror directed against the people, the German people, who had been against their will included in that state. But until 1938, we tolerated it. Then we found out the truth. Pierre Coe, the French air minister, he told the world why Czechoslovakia remained in existence. He declared We need that state. We need it for its economic situation. We need it to prevent Germany from going farther into Europe. We need it as a base for air raids against Germany. And then the Bolsheviki, too. They wanted to use this state as a corridor into the heart of Europe. This state, which is practically a minority state, since it is a minority people that functions as its government, is a state that is in the hands of a man like Benesch. Whoever opposes Benesch is persecuted. And in this state, we have seen that the conqueror is the most cruel. We have seen that in the German population, that they have a higher death rate than any other, that they have a higher child mortality than any other, that there is a lower standard of living because of the poverty of the region. This is what the Czechs have done in Czechoslovakia to the Germans for the past 20 years. Then, if there are traitors, how many are there? Yes, 10,000, 100,000, 1 million, 3.5 million. Today, across the Alps, we find one man. He is the leader of the Italian people. I have said, with reference to that man, that we understand one another. We have been told that Germany mobilized against Czechoslovakia. That is a lie. It was the Czechs who mobilized. We thought that the right of self-determination after 20 years but finally be given. And now, at this point, my notes are so sketchy that I'm going to ask your patience for just a moment or two while I study them, and will then come back on the air with a further translation.
And Mr. Kaltenborn and ladies and gentlemen, because in all likelihood will be of great international interest, we present at this time a talk by Clark M. Eichelberger, director of the League of Nations Association, speaking from Geneva. We take you now to Geneva, Switzerland.
Friday night, the president of the League of Nations Assembly, Mr. De Valera, gave the annual party which the president gives statesmen, journalists, and guests. There were over 1,000 people in attendance, many of whom were delegates representing their countries. They included some 20 foreign ministers and between 50 and 60 ambassadors. In times gone by, these parties have been gay with music and dancing. But Friday night, Mr. De Valera asked his guests not to dance because of the seriousness of the international situation. Delegates stood in groups discussing affairs. Reports were coming in every few minutes from the capitals of Europe, and also from news agencies scattered all the way from London to Moscow. Today, the atmosphere is very much the same. Delegates are attending commission meetings, dealing with every conceivable subject from economic stability to nutrition. But they are nervous, preoccupied, conscious of the shadow which hangs over them, a shadow which, as you have undoubtedly learned from other broadcasts, is hourly growing darker. I presume the people of the United States are wondering what Geneva thinks of the present situation tonight and of the future. It may seem to some that the League of Nations is of the present crisis, but not in it, because the issue has not yet been formally presented to the League for Action, and because the major discussions, such as those between Chamberlain and Hitler, have taken place in ignorance of the League. However, here is mobilized the world public opinion, which expresses the conscience of the overwhelming part of the world. Some of that I would like to give you tonight. In addition, the discussions have referred to, and some have dealt openly with, the present crisis. Mr. Litvinov's speech, in which he reviewed some of the negotiations, and in which he reaffirmed Russia's intention of standing by her agreements with France over Czechoslovakia, has been one of the most important declarations. If the French and the British were for the moment ignoring Russia in the negotiations, Mr. Litvinov could inform their delegates, as well as the definite delegates of 50 other nations, as to his country's position to an address in the Assembly. The Foreign Minister of France, the President of the French Chamber, the Lord Privy Seal of Great Britain, I've made emergency trips to have conferences with the statesmen assembled here. However, Geneva will be the center, rather than the rim of the negotiations. If Czechoslovakia should be attacked, and Great Britain, France, and Russia go to her aid, the terms of the treaties between France and Czechoslovakia, France and Russia, Russia and Czechoslovakia, would presume that in case of aggression against Prague, the matter would be immediately laid before the League of Nations Council. If the Council achieves unanimity in determining the facts of aggression under Article 16, the nations will automatically go to Czechoslovakia's aid. And in fact, if the Council cannot achieve unanimity, France and Russia will automatically go to Czechoslovakia's aid. But the important point is that there will probably be a deliberation on the part of the world community before France and Russia go to the aid of Prague. Great Britain, while not bound by these specific treaties, is nevertheless bound by the covenant and will be equally as anxious to have the judgment of the community of nations upon her defense of a member attack in violation of international law. As one prominent statesman said to me this morning, if on Saturday, when the date line of Hitler's ultimatum expires, Czechoslovakia is attacked, Geneva will be one of the centers of the negotiations. The opinions of hundreds of statesmen, newspaper men, and observers on any single issue must of necessity be mixed. Nevertheless, certain commonly held opinions and trends are evident. There was undoubtedly in many circles admiration for Chamberlain's first visit to Berchtesgaden Garden. Since prestige is not an issue with democratic statesmen as it is with dictators, Chamberlain could afford to fly to Hitler for his first talk. There was a general sigh of relief that his visit meant negotiations. And as President Roosevelt said in his telegram this morning, as long as negotiations continue, there cannot be war. But a day or so after Chamberlain's first visit, the feeling of satisfaction gave way to stupefaction, then indignation, at the position in which Czechoslovakia was placed. It will be remembered that President Beneš was awakened in the early hours of the morning by the French and British ambassadors, who demanded that he accept the terms immediately which Mr. Chamberlain was to take back to Germany. The Czechoslovakian government, in a radio broadcast, has characterized the brutality and the haste of this démarche as unparalleled in history. These circumstances, plus the fact that it is the second interview, Hitler rejected the terms which Mr. Chamberlain had reason to believe would be accepted, and made further impossible demands, which have been transmitted to Prague in the nature of a German ultimatum, have maneuvered Prague into the position of a defeated power, being presented with ultimatums from friends and enemies alike. There is universal resentment, characterized by a stiffening of opinion here, in London and in Paris, that a law-abiding democratic state such as Czechoslovakia should have been placed in this position. Many felt that a rectification of the frontier, which would transfer 1 million or more Germans to Germany, assuming that they wanted that transfer, and providing the Czechoslovakian economy and frontier defenses be as disturbed as little as possible, might in the long run not be too bad. There were many who said, when Mr. Chamberlain made his first visit, and the communiques of the French and British as to the purpose of his visit gave color to the belief that Chamberlain had in mind a major settlement and would astonish and please the world with plans for a program of European appeasement in which Hitler would be a willing partner. However, as the original Czechoslovakian sacrifice has been followed by a German ultimatum containing demands that, if accepted, would destroy the Czech state, and as it has become clear that the British and French have secured no promises for a freely negotiated agreement for European appeasement, astonishment and resentment grow. The speech of Chancellor Hitler was given but a few minutes ago, and I would not presume to comment on Geneva's reaction to it. Today's appeal by President Roosevelt, however, urging nations to respect the Kellogg Pact and other treaties and to continue negotiations for a peaceful settlement, was received with great satisfaction. Obviously, there could be no war if the Kellogg Pact and other treaties were observed. There was something very impressive in the President's appeal in the name of 130 million Americans. That's one journalist remarked. He represents a great many people and tremendous economic strength. Now as to the future. Who can tell what Saturday will bring? Of Saturday that is already being referred to here as Black Saturday. There are those who believe that war cannot be avoided, that British and French public opinion, now thoroughly aroused, will not permit their governments to drive the checks to further sacrifices that would mean the disappearance of their state. Also, the Chancellor Hitler has taken such a strong position in submitting an ultimatum with a Saturday deadline that he cannot retreat. Others feel that Germany is not ready for war and does not wish war, and will find ways of conciliating her permission, her position, if met by a determined will on the part of the Czechs, French, British, and Russians. Czechoslovakia is not without friends today. The two other partners of the Petite Entente have made it clear to Hungary that they will not permit an attack on Prague. There are many who feel, and I am one of that number, that war is not inevitable. That firm determination to resist aggression, plus the appeal to conciliation issued by President Roosevelt, may turn the scales in favor of peace. Now as to the more long-distance future. What of next week, next month, next year? Obviously, the nations wish the crisis of today resolved so satisfactorily that it will not arise in a greater threat to peace when the winter is over and the warmth of spring is a temptation to militarists to further adventures. There are those, men who went through the last war, statesmen who realize the grave responsibility resting upon them, who say that if the only way to avoid war today is to impose such an imperial position upon democratic forces, that war would be inevitable in 6 months, with the democracies materially weakened, it would actually be better that the conflict came today. There are those who say that at the precise moment that the French and British ambassadors told Fenech he must accept the Chamberlain plan, and that only in that way could an attack be avoided, that at that moment, after an armistice of 20 years, Germany became the victor of the World War.